study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna meet my dear Jesus down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Gonna meet my dear Jesus down by the riverside. Gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my burdens down by the riverside. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, gonna lay down my burdens. Down by the riverside, gonna study war no more. Ain't 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 gonna study war no more.
Right on the button, but I wasn't ready. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, let me pull this over so you can hear me, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, the return, the first return in this new time slot of the, well, first guest who we had in this time slot, Richard Bowes. Stay tuned. And good morning. Yeah, Rick, we're sitting here chatting, and Rick is not yet used to, and neither am I, to the new pattern of this show, because it's 90 minutes instead of 2 hours. So I don't play music. It's, you know, one of the main things. It's a different pace, being not 5 a.m., but 1:30 in the morning, which it is actually 1:34 and a half. And depending on where you're listening, there are new technologies, by the way, if this one works. I read an article by David Pogue about 4 or 5 weeks ago about digital audio recording, DAR, which basically is sort of like TiVo for radio. And they record whatever radio program you ask them to do, and then you can pick it up on software like MP3 tunes on pretty much any device in the world. It's really cool. Hasn't worked for this show yet. They've gotten time zones wrong. Like I explained, the show is at 1:30 in the morning, so it starts recording at 4:30. Well, it's because it's PST. No, it goes the other way. We're on at 10:30. If you're listening right now through the internet stream at WBAI.org, it's now 10:30 in LA. And so I'm hoping that this week it worked out. Sadly, last week it did not. But you can still hear last week's show by going to archive.wbai.org, or even better, go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. I know how old it looks, but it has a link that'll take you right to the streams for just my show. And last week's show was highly amusing, given the guest Michael Swanwick, but no less so than this week and next week. Next week on the program, Paul Witkover, who I initially asked because Paul Witkover is, well, an intense fan of Green Lantern. Now, I have not seen the movie, don't know much about it, don't know that I'm dying to go see it. But, you know, somebody who I knew, who used to be on the show when he was alive, Alfred Bester, was the one who wrote that little poem that they do, you know, in Dark of Night.
That's right.
Yeah.
I had forgotten that. He was a man of many talents.
He was a man of many talents and popping up all the place. And he, Alfie Bester, wrote the Green Lantern
song.
Well, I think, you know, we'll not delay, you know, in darkest night with a Green Lantern, we'll not stop this mailman from delivering. Robert has one. Robert has joined the is it a legion? What is it with the Green Lantern?
The Corps.
The Green. Okay, Corps. Okay.
Yes, not just a legion.
He knows more about it than I do.
Evan Sore is waiting out in the hallway.
Yeah, right. So next week, Paul Witkover, who I believe has actually written an amount of Green Lantern prose.
Has he?
There has been an unusual amount of Green Lantern prose. Well, we'll ask next week. But I'm not sure that I don't think we're going to dedicate the entire show to Green Lantern.
Oh, I think.
Because Paul is a fine writer who's
has this one
credits
weakness.
Will stand up on their own without all that. But Ken Gale, who is not so much WBAI's ecologist and ornithologist as he is WBAI's comic book expert, who knows, you know, about that minor stuff, climate change, you know, whatever that. Why change the climate? You know. Like, anyway, so Ken, when I mentioned to him we're going to be doing the show, he says, I know a lot about the Green Lantern. Anyway.
Scandalous stuff?
I don't know.
Well, good.
Given
be.
Ken Gale, yeah, who knows be. What it could I mean, be. I want to know what the ecological impact of the core would be. What happens if a superhero, every time Robert's liking this. Hey, what happens if every time a superhero, you know, does its thing, right? It does something to the atmosphere. It gets rid of, like, some of the ultraviolet protection or something like that.
Oh, sure. The tropospheric disturbances of Superman's flight.
There's a good one.
Many of these things.
Or the conservation of momentum, the impulse. How can he leap to fly without catastrophically destroying the sidewalk?
That there are many, many things about Superman do not add up in terms of physics, yes.
The first person to explore that, really, that kind of stuff was Larry Niven.
Yes.
Classic story that I don't think would play well today, the way it did in the 70s.
Be an ecological movement calling itself the Green Lanterns.
Oh, keep the Green Lantern green. There you go. Anyway. And what about the ornithological aspect? Richard Bowes is our guest. And Rick Bowes as... yes, I know, it's Richard. You look at the books... The many books that are out have been out, and it says Richard on the side. But when you meet this person, good night, Robert. You see, it's never Bob Knight. It's always Robert Knight.
It's always Robert. Well, it's, you know.
But you're generally Rick.
I'm generally Rick. When the first book came out, they said you have to decide now whether you're going to be Richard or Rick. And I said Richard, and that's been with me ever since. And, you know, I know how to spell it, and it's... It's all right. It's worked for me.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who refer to me as James. I accept that. It's Jimmy that for some reason I abandoned when I was about 12.
Well, when I first came to New York, which was in like the mid-60s, I worked in fashion copywriting, and my nickname was Dick. And I don't know why. And I worked in an office with three other people who were named Richard, and we were all Dick. It was Short Dick and Fat Dick and Tall Dick, and I forget what the fourth one was.
Probably Long.
No, Tall was the closest we came.
Okay.
But I figured, yes. But other than that, yes, I've been Rick.
And since people who have heard you, I don't know how many times you've been on this program live at this point.
Been on the program. How many times I've been live? Is that what you're asking me?
No. Reshuffling the words. How many times? How many live broadcasts have you done on Hour of the Wolf?
I don't know. Quite a few.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
One of the best and most notable of your appearances on WBAI wasn't even on Hour of the Wolf.
That's right. It was that
Cat Radio Cafe,
and it was. There's a Hole in the City, which you had tricked up, and you took like seconds from between each word. And
that's exactly it. Yeah,
yeah. I was really in love with the sound of my own voice there. It really sounded stupendous.
It did an amazing thing. It not only got rid of some of the silences between, but somehow that software I used. Did a certain kind of compression without changing the timbre of your voice.
Yeah, it was great. I just wish I actually sounded like that.
Well, now you did.
Yeah, for that moment I did. I mean, it's kind of strange because the story, I mean, it's about 9/11, so it's not exactly a happy thing. But, yeah, I sounded great.
Yeah, I'm putting together, we got a note from our program director just yesterday, we being the producers here of WBAI, asking us now for our proposals of broadcasts on September 11th of this year, the 10th anniversary. And I am renominating the Cat Radio Cafe broadcast.
When they did it, they had on a psychiatrist.
From Columbia. Do you remember his name?
I don't remember his name.
I have to ask Janet Coleman who produced
that. To remember my own name. But he was terrific, actually.
He really was. The things that he talked about, we all knew, who had read it, that the depth of the story was quite astonishing, not to mention the fact that it's simply 9/11 or not, a lovely story.
Well, thank you. It was strange because it was written in 2005, and at that moment, suddenly 9/11 stories were all over the place. It took a little while, I guess, for people to formulate them. Something, I don't know.
I think it was that everybody was so stunned that nobody actually had the guts to actually start fictionalizing this event that was reverberating so much you could barely talk about it on TV or radio, including at WBAI, in anything but hushed tones.
Hushed tones, yes. Right. It was, but yeah, that moment, that was the moment where it suddenly became a viable
is actually
product.
The real word, yeah. And let's see, let us tell people more about things that bear the byline of Richard Bowes.
Well, what I'm going to do tonight is to read a story from a themed anthology. It's Naked City, and it's an urban fantasy anthology. It skews towards detectives and mystery, but it's far from being just that. It's a mixture of fantasy and science fiction writers and mystery
writers. And crime genre.
Yeah, Jim Butcher, Patricia Briggs, Melissa Marr, and Holly Black are the headline names here, and that's certainly a
Patricia Briggs has made it.
Yep, Patricia Briggs is right up there with Jim Butcher and Melissa Marr and Holly Black.
That's
but
in terms
of the fantasy, there's Peter Beagle and Elizabeth Baer, John Crowley, Jeff Ford, and Ellen Kushner, Deirdre Sherman, Kit Reed, Lucia Shepard, and people like me.
I would say you belong in that company. They should be pleased to be in there with you.
I hope they are.
And who put this book together?
This was put
knowing
together.
That Lo is listening.
Yes, is she? I don't know. I think she's on her way to.
If there's a chance that her name will be mentioned, she'll listen retroactively.
Right. She's on her way to Seattle at this point. But Ellen Detlow, it was the editor of this, as she has been for so many other anthologies. And it is not on sale yet. It will publish on July 5th. And the pre-sales are very, very good. Pre-publication sales are very good. It's doing very well on Amazon, which is really the only thing one can check on.
For pre-sales, yeah.
For pre-sales, yes.
Well, there was a time when the New York Times would check orders that book companies put into publishers.
Right. Those tend to, I mean, there are problems with anything.
Well, given that once a book that hadn't been written made the bestseller list as a result of this methodology.
Yes. Yes.
A book that was ghosted by Theodore Sturgeon.
Yes. indeed it was. But, yeah, all kinds of stories. Anyway, Naked City is the anthology, and everyone should rush out and order it. Right?
This minute.
Not this minute. You should listen to me read first,
okay.
And
so
then you
3
should rush out.
With Lister's show on in the background.
Yes, you will go to Amazon and order it. And
I was thinking find an online bookstore. Why wait?
It's not published yet because it hasn't come out yet.
Oh, that's right.
It hasn't come out yet. Yeah, so otherwise, I would, tell them to go to an online bookstore.
Okay, fine.
And we'll begin now.
Well, no. Tell us a couple of your novels. You've talked about this one book.
I've talked about this one book. The novels that I've written, I don't have that many considering how long I've been around. But I started in the...
But they're terse.
I think so, and my mother thought so. But I started back in the mid-80s, and I wrote War Child. I was the first one to write a novel called War Child. Several people have written novels called War Child since, but I was the first. I have that honor. And I wrote Feral Cell, and I wrote Goblin Market. And then there was a long hiatus in which I wrote short stories, and a bunch of those became the novel Minions of the Moon. And Minions of the Moon, one of the stories won the World Fantasy Award, which was very nice. Streetcar Dreams was the story. And
right.
Minions itself won the Lambda for Best Gay Novel of that year and was nominated for some other awards. And then a few years later, I again had a bunch of stories, this time about time travel and the Greek gods. Greek gods and time travel, which I don't think had ever been combined before. And that was from the files of the Time Rangers, which was a Nebula nominee.
And the title is really, you know, it doesn't give you the feel of the book. It's a pulp title with none of the trappings of pulp fiction.
Well, one of the characters in it is a pulp fiction writer from the 1940s and 50s, and there are excerpts from his stories in there. And so it does have that. But
it intersects.
It intersects, but yes, from the files of the
but
time.
But it's a misleading title if one isn't actually...
Right, if one actually thinks that one is going to get a...
If you tell somebody to buy a book called From the Files of the Time Rangers, they figure that's like they figure based on a cartoon
it's
series.
It's going to be Tom Corbett Space Cadet, yes, is what they think they're going to get. And they will be, I suppose...
Sorely disappointed.
Sorely disappointed, yes. It must be a horrible thing for them. I feel sorry for them. Then I wrote a whole bunch of stories, and they were together in a thing called Dust Devil, My Life in Speculative Fiction, and that is out looking for a home at this point.
Out meaning out to publishers.
Out to publishers.
Right.
I just put that, I think it was 15 stories altogether. That was really quite incredible. And so that's what is true with the novels. Recently, I've had a whole bunch of stories published, and there are many others forthcoming. The ones this year, I think I have 7 stories coming out this year, and 4 of them are from what we call themed anthologies. It'd be a bunch of stories around a certain subject. The one that came out already is Beware the Night by Kathy Sidia, and that's... werewolves, were stories of various kinds. And I had were actors, people who become actors, much better actors when the moon is full. And that is out already.
I think I know one of them.
I grew up with a couple of them. But, but yes, there is another one called Blood and Other Cravings, also edited by Alan Dadlow, which... was released today. Now, why am I not reading a story from that one? Because I'm not. Blood and Other Cravings.
Fine. It's author's choice here.
It's an author's choice. It's not editor's duty. Well, it's author's choice, and also I had forgotten that it was coming out today. Blood and Other Cravings. No, that's coming out in September. I'm sorry.
Ah,
I'm sorry.
I was wondering why I hadn't even seen
right.
Supernatural Noir.
Supernatural Noir is the one that came out today. And Supernatural Noir has a terrific cover of a raven and a young lady. And
coming from Dark Horse Books,
Dark Horse Books is related to the comic company.
Yeah.
Comic publishers. And
so the graphic quality does not come as a surprise that it's got a gorgeous cover.
It does. It has a wonderful cover. And the stories, I believe, are... I've read a couple of the stories. A couple of the writers showed me their stories. And I read my story. I know people think that I don't, but I did. I read my story all the way through. And I think it's a good story. It's called Mortal Bait. The other contributors are Greg Frost, Paul Tremblay, Melanie Tem, Lucia Shepard, Jeffrey Ford, Laird Barron, Elizabeth Baer, Joe R. Lansdale, who just won the Stoker Award for Best Long Short Fiction, for a story from another Dadlow anthology, Haunted Legends, which also won the Stoker.
Oh, right.
I'm in that one, too. Lee Thomas, Tom Picciarilli, Nate Southard, Brian Evanson, Caitlin Kernan, Nick Mamatas, and Joshua Langan are the other contributors to Supernatural Noir, which is out and which I think will be terrific. And it's similarly themed, actually, to Naked City. I think, in fact, Supernatural Noir is more detective stories, although I'll have to read all the stories to be sure. Whereas Naked City is urban fantasy. It's fantasy taking place in the city. And some of the stories are concerned with detectives and law enforcement, but others have other...
Because themes. The name Naked City makes you think of Barry Fitzgerald.
It makes you think of Barry Fitzgerald, or like that incredible early 60s television series, which was my image of New York City when I moved here. And I discovered that...
Except we're in color, sort of.
Well, New York is in color, yes.
Grimy,
but in color, whereas the series was black and white. And I realized when I saw the series again some years ago that they had intentionally made the New York of 1960 look like the New York of the Ouija photographs, which was the 1940s, and that the real New York by that time, thank God, looked somewhat different. I'm sorry, what?
No, you were mid-sentence. I was thinking now we should, you know, give you a chance to get on to the...
I should start reading the story because people will become...
Do you want to take a quick break first?
Let me take a little break.
Okay, let's see. I'm just wondering, do I have any announcements that I really need to make to tell you all about different things? And the answer is no, not really. So we'll just listen to a bit of music, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Driving Crazy is the name of that bit of music from the soundtrack of the motion picture, Silent Running. And by the way, the music that we open the program with is also from Silent Running.
Was that also Silent Running?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Compositions by Peter Schickele.
Right. That's his big film score.
He did four film scores, but this is his big one.
Yeah.
The one that really got recognition, and it's lovely music. Margot Adler chose it for the theme of this program.
Okay.
I'm sorry, and let me just, since this will be last chance for half an hour, let me reintroduce the program and say that this is Hour of the Wolf. You're tuned to WBAI in New York City at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. Having gotten that out of the way, I'm Jim Freund. With me, Rick Bowes.
And the story is on the slide. Sean Quinlan caught the 6:30 wake-up call almost before his cell phone began its first ring. He murmured thanks, glanced at Adrienne Laferrisse, who wore only a soft, lovely smile and barely stirred in her sleep. Thrust the phone aside, slipped from the bed in the pearly morning light, and padded quietly out of the room. He wasn't awake so much as in a place where the line between work and dreams had been erased. In the ample living room, he flicked on the DVD player, keeping the sound way down. In the kitchen, he started the coffee. Back in the living room, he sat in his shorts on the arm of the couch and watched the opening scene, an episode of the old Naked City TV show. Grainy black-and-white detectives in suits and hats chased a gunman over the roofs of early 1960s New York. Sun through the apartment windows made the gray figures look like ghosts, and Quinlan liked that effect. The gunman turned to fire, and the detectives ducked behind a chimney. An actor playing a uniformed cop fell, shot. The fugitive fled down a fire escape, with the two detectives firing after him. Quinlan turned up the sound half a notch to catch the voice of the old character actor who played the hard-bitten police lieutenant in the series. Wounded in the hunt, the law on his trail, the fugitive returns to his final lair, his first home, the old neighborhood. The trumpets playing the City at Dawn theme music mix nicely with the early rush hour street noise from downtown Manhattan 50 years later. The episode was set in a neighborhood of five-story tenements that Quinlan didn't quite recognize. It had probably been torn down and turned into high-rises. When coffee smells spread, he stood and discovered Adrienne in a floor-length robe with her eyes barely open, leaning in the doorway and watching him. Her smile was gone. "More detective," she mumbled. "You never stop working, do you, Sam? Sean, my granddad and friends used to make fun of what they called 24-hour-a-day cops, guys who are always on duty," he said. "Now it's like I've become one. Can I offer you some of your own coffee?" "Yes, please." She made her way to the bathroom, saying, "When we were kids, I remember guys backing off from confronting you because they just knew you were the law." Adrienne Laferrisse had been A.D. Jacobson when they were in their early 20s, and she waited tables while he took care of the door at Club Red Light over in the meatpacking district back in the now legendary early 90s. She returned, saying, "I don't need to be up this early. I don't need to be up at all. With business the way it is, I could spend the day in bed, and I think I will." She uttered some variation on that every morning and never followed through. His divorce had left him broke. Eddie's divorce from Henry Laferrisse, the designer, was much more successful, leaving her with this renovated condo and a partnership in a prosperous real estate business. Sadly, like everything else in New York, that agency was now in the tank. Over the last several years, they'd made it their pleasant habit to get together like this each time he'd been in New York on a job, and it was in Quinlan's mind to see if they could turn this into something more permanent. When he brought Adie the coffee and half a Bialy, she was sitting up in bed reading email on her laptop. "No apartment in Manhattan is going to be sold today. Everybody who owns one remembers when it was worth $2 million. Anyone who wants one will offer a quarter of that, and then either can't get financing or can't explain where he got the money." Quinlan took a jacket and slacks out of the corner of the closet that he'd been assigned, got socks and underwear from the rolling suitcase in which he'd brought them. In the bathroom, he stared through the steam at the serviceable face he was shaving, the short hair with almost no gray. The family face, anonymous and perfect for stakeout work. His grandfather, Black Jack Quinlan, had said. Jack Quinlan had made detective lieutenant on the job. He'd died almost 30 years back when Sean was barely 13. He thought about the old man almost every day. Sean looked in the mirror and smiled just a bit. Lately, he'd had occasion to notice that the Quinlan face was also perfect for a man on the run. He put on a jacket and shirt, but no tie, because suddenly there wasn't time. On the way to the bedroom, he picked up the round snap brim he'd been wearing for practice and put it on his head with just enough tilt. When he kissed Adie, she said, "Brazil. I've got a Brazilian with money interested in a penthouse. And with that trade agreement, he doesn't even have to explain where he got the cash." Then she looked up and said, "You are beyond retro, mister. If you disappear, I'll start believing in sliders. People talk about sliders. Have you ever known one? It's escapism, not reality. I think they took the name from some old TV show nobody watched. I know a woman who described her teenage son as a perfect 1969 hippie. He had the clothes and the hair. His room was papered with old posters, and he hardly ever left it. One morning he disappeared, and she thinks he slid back there. Claims she found notes from him written in old yellow paper and telling her he was okay. Of course, she's also delusional enough to think the Dow will hit 18,000 some fine day. Turning to go, he said, "Remember the Peggy Hughes party tonight?" Adie nodded and pointed to a set of handcuffs attached to one of the brass rods on the headboard. "Can you hide those before you go? The cleaning lady's coming today." Outside on Rivington Street, it was still early enough that Quinlan got a cab with no problem. This Lower East Side drug pit of his youth had gotten gentrified and hip beyond measure. But times like this, on mornings with bright, merciless sun shining on empty shop windows, it was starting to look a bit shabby again. As the cab rolled across Houston Street into the East Village, he noticed people setting up folding tables on the widened sidewalks, opening for business in the big informal flea market that had grown up there. Portable dressing rooms lined Avenue B. On 10th Street, police barricades blocked traffic onto that side street. Ms. Rheingold posters and ads for Pall Mall covered over the Mexican restaurant and reflexology parlor signs. Extras were ready to stand on the corner and grease their haircuts or lean out of first-floor windows in housecoats and hairnets. Down the block, lights brighter than the sun illuminated the tenement. Getting out of the cab, Quinlan was spotted by a couple of the film crew. "Morning, officer," one said, and they all laughed. For their amusement and his own, he did an imitation of the old cop he'd heard on TV. "This is my once and future city. My life consists of long periods of waiting and brief flashes of action and violence. My name is Sean Quinlan. When I can get the work, I'm an actor." Big parts of Quinlan's life were in a condition he didn't want to think about, but he had a good part in a medium-sized film. Nothing else would matter for the next few hours. Now, this is movie direction that comes next. At 9:22, one day in the spring of 1960, New York police detective Peter McDevitt climbs out of an unmarked Buick, flicks his half-smoked cigarette away, and steps into East 10th Street. His suit is gray and his shirt is blue to match his eyes. His tie is blood red and his hat is tilted back a tad to give full value to his face. Detective Pat Rourke exits from the driver's side, wearing brown, with a white shirt and blue tie, as befits a steady backup man and faithful partner. McDevitt was played by Zack Terry, star of Like 60, a Hollywood production currently shooting exteriors on the streets of New York City. Detective Rourke was Sean Quinlan's role. As a featured player, it was his duty to exit on the far side of the car and step smoothly into his proper place, one pace behind and 2 feet to the left of the star. Pete McDevitt keeps his eyes fastened on an upper floor of the tenement opposite, but Pat Rourke gives a quick scan over his shoulder to see if anyone is watching them. Quinlan had planted that gesture in rehearsal and put it in each of the takes, wanting it there to emphasize that his character was the competent by-the-book cop. No one had commented one way or the other. What he kept in his mind was a street full of guys and women setting out dressed for work, kids going to school on a spring day over 50 years before. He blocked out what he actually saw, the trucks, the crew, the commissary table, the lights and the crowd of gawkers. Sean Quinlan felt a bit dizzy, like he was about to fall or maybe fly, and wondered if this was how the start of a slide felt. He had created a background for his character. Rourke and McDevitt were supposed to pick up Jimmy Nails, a two-bit thug suspected of having ambitions above his station, for questioning. Rourke was a 10-year veteran of the force, a guy with a wife and 2 kids, was talking about moving to the suburbs. He would not be bouncing on his toes on an ordinary morning on a routine assignment. A sound crew moved with them just out of camera range as the two cops continued a conversation that the audience would have heard them have in the car. That scene got filmed in California a couple of weeks back. "Definitely it's spring, Pat, my boy," says McDevitt, and comes to a halt. Rourke's expression is mildly amused, a bit bored, as he follows the other's gaze. Without looking, Quinlan knew Terry was wearing the trademark half-bemused, half-aroused little grin he had used at least once in every episode of Angel House. Then Rourke sees what McDevitt sees, and his jaw drops just a bit. They hold the pose. "Cut," says Mitchell Graham, the director. "I think we may have it." Crew members moved. Traffic began to flow. Zack Terry looked Sean Quinlan up and down for a moment before the two of them stepped apart. The actors had worked together once a couple of years before when Quinlan appeared in an episode of Angel House. That's the HBO series featuring a law office whose partners are angels, but not necessarily good ones. An amusing show, Quinlan thought, once you accepted the premise. Terry was one of the stars. Quinlan had played a quirky hitman who didn't happen to be guilty of the killing with which he had been charged. Their two scenes together had gone well, and Quinlan hoped the look just then didn't mean some kind of tension. On the way back to his dressing room, he passed a girl, maybe 20, in pedal pushes, teased hair, and pumps. She smiled, and he turned to watch her walk away. A production assistant saw him look and said, "That kid has all the moves. This location is a magnet for sliders. They think if they dress in period and hang around sites like this, they'll wake up in 1960. One told me that the trick was not to think about sliding back while you did all that." The kid had a nice ass, but not enough to make his head spin like it did. In his dressing room, Quinlan did relaxation exercises, sipped iced tea, sat silently for a few minutes, and finally listened to his calls. Arroyo, the lawyer, was first. "Sean, I assume everything you wanted to keep is already out of the condo. As of today, it's repossessed. Second, my colleague who's handling your case up in San Bernardino says there's no word from the DA's office. We don't know if an indictment is coming down. But as we discussed, an indictment is just their way of getting you to testify. I'm wondering if you got my bill." Quinlan had gotten the bill. The condo was one more casualty of his divorce and bankruptcy. When he could have sold, he couldn't bring himself to do it. When he had to sell, there were no buyers. Everyone had consoled him about the divorce, like it suffered a death in the family or been laid off from work. Monica Celeste had the better career, was a major presence on daytime cable. Quinlan told himself that if the situation had been reversed, he wouldn't have dumped her. But all that was in the past. The San Bernardino matter was current. A runaway grand jury led by a self-righteous young DA was investigating collection agency practices. Some debtors apparently testified that a few years before, Quinlan had led them to believe he was a cop. So far, nothing had gotten out to the media. That time, just after the divorce, was still a jumble in his mind. One thing he was sure of was that testifying meant implicating his fellow employers, which would be very unwise. Another thing about which he was positive was that lawyers had eaten up his, like, 60 pay. Addie was in the office in full business mode when she left a message. "For the Peggy Hughes thing, we can meet at Ormolu at 8. I mentioned that to a prospective client, and he knew all about it, so we may meet him there." The last call was a voice from a disreputable past. Roland said, "You asked around about me. Here I am. I know where to find you." Quinlan was a bit amused. When they knocked on his door to say he was due on the set, Quinlan thought about his character for a few moments. Roark had the usual problems, trying to raise a family on a cop's salary. His wife and he had disagreements, but she was a cop's wife and understood what that meant. A steady guy was Roark, a good partner. Detectives McDevitt and Roark hold the same poses as at the end of the previous scene. The audience has just watched a sequence shot 2 weeks before on a soundstage in California. It shows what the two cops are watching, a nude woman standing behind gauze curtains. The viewers see a reverse strip as she hooks a bra, pulls up her panties, draws on nylons, wriggles into a slip, a blouse, and a skirt. She bends slowly to put on her shoes. Suddenly, McDevitt shakes himself awake. "Decoy," he said. "She's letting him get away." The pair of them run for the front door of the building. Locations had found an untouched and ungentrified tenement. Props had filled dented cans in front with in-period trash, a partly crushed Wheaties box, a broken Coke bottle, a striped pillow leaking feathers. A little old lady with a wheeled shopping cart gets in their way. The stoop is worn and paint is peeling on the railings. As they run up the stairs, the front door opens. And there stands Laura Shant, the first time the audience gets a good look at her. Laura is the girlfriend of a very wrong guy, hard but soft, bad but good. She wears high heels, a black sheath skirt, and a jacket open to reveal a pale, shimmering blouse. A scarf with a streak of scarlet covers most of her blonde hair. "You boys looking for someone?" she asks, with an innocent expression. Laura was played by the young London actress Moira Tell. Her posture, her accent, her attitude were impeccable. Part 2. Peggy McHugh still had a sassy smile. Back in the 50s and 60s, she had made a career playing bright young girlfriends and wisecracking best pals of two sweet heroines. She was the young detective's fiancée in the Naked City TV series. At 80, she played tough old broads with a regular role on a daytime soap, a girlfriend 20 years her junior. In a nod to nostalgia, she had been cast as Detective Pete McDevitt's hip, utterly unsentimental grandmother in this movie. It was her birthday, and Mitchell Graham, the director, along with the movie's producers, threw a little party for her at Ormolu's on Union Square and invited the press. Miss Hughes had already knocked back a Jameson on the rocks and was swirling champagne in her glass when Quinlan came up and hugged her. "How are you doing, you old witch?" he asked. "Sean, I thought I'd see more of you on this shoot. How's your mother? Still living in New Mexico with what's-his-name?" Peggy McHugh and Quinlan's mother, the former Julie Morris, had been pals back when his mother was acting, back when she married his father, Detective Jim Quinlan. Arizona. Lou Hagen is the current husband. Nice guy. Retired broker. She's fine. Sends her love. "Your mother was gorgeous. She and your father, when they met, were more like a movie than any movie I've been in." And having taken the conversation to a place where Quinlan didn't want to go, Peggy caught sight of someone else and said, "Bella, so wonderful of you to come." Quinlan stepped away, went to the bar, sipped a scotch, and looked around the room. Ormolu's tin ceiling had been polished to a fine shine. The wood paneling looked rich as chocolate. The place had been a dump 20 years before when it was a rock club called Ladders. Long before that, it had been an Italian wedding hall. Sean's parents were quite a story, the young actress and the young cop who got himself quite dirty trying to keep her in style. Jim Quinlan shot himself when the dirt came down. Sean had been 3 when that happened and found it out in bits and pieces. Once when he was small, his grandfather had explained how it was growing up in the Irish New York of the 20s and 30s. Kids who got in trouble, which was most of us, got let off with a warning if we had cops in the family. Those without a relative on the force got a criminal record. Simple justice and nothing less. Out of nowhere, Quinlan asked about the father whom he barely remembered and knew almost nothing. "Did my dad get into trouble?" He never forgot the grief on the old man's face as he said, "Your father got more than a couple of warnings." Addie was across the room, talking intently to a thin man wearing thousands of dollars worth of suit and a long dark ponytail. Where Quinlan was standing, he could hear Mitchell Graham say, "Sometimes acting is beside the point, and it's the physical presence you want. Someone walks on camera unannounced, and the audience knows he's a killer." Quinlan shifted slightly and saw that the director was talking to Moira Tell and a reporter. In America, real mafiosa go to jail, get involved in the prison drama group, get out and go into business playing mafioso on stage and screen. When Friedkin shot Sorcerer down in Latin America, he hired a couple of Sing Sing School of Drama graduates to play the thugs. The two stopped off on the way down there and helped pull the robbery. This delayed them and held up the shooting. When they showed up, Roy Scheider, the star, said, "I was told we were waiting for actors. These are just gangsters." Supposedly, the two were deeply hurt that their artistic bona fides were being questioned. Moira Tell laughed and moved toward the bar. On her way, she noticed Quinlan. "You were very good," she told him. "Sing Sing School of Drama. Oh, he was not talking about you. Graham admires what you're doing, the presence you bring. He believes all that nonsense about inner emotion, American versus exterior detail British acting. You were great this afternoon. It's wonderful to visit a past that has nothing to do with me at all." From across the room, he heard Peggy McHugh in full voice speaking to a cable interviewer. "Back when the economy was first going down the toilet, someone asked me if I'd like to go back 60 years. I thought they meant, would I like to be young again? Instead, they just meant me going back as I was, before heart bypasses, before air conditioning. I asked them, 'You're out of your mind,' I said. Sweetheart, we lived like dogs back then." Eddie said as they were leaving later, "The one I was talking to was the Brazilian from this morning. He wants to buy a penthouse. He's loaded." Somehow money had not really come up in all the years they'd known each other. Part 3. The ferry boat, called the Queen of Union City, disembarks passengers onto a Hudson River pier in the West 20s. A woman wearing a veiled hat leads a small boy in an Eton cap and a girl in a straw boater by their hands. A tall man in a three-piece suit and a topcoat follows them. An old slat-sided truck, piled with crates of live chickens, rolls onto the pier past a large sign reading, "Erie Lackawanna Ferry Company." Under that in smaller letters, is Departures from Manhattan on the Hour and Half Hour, 4 a.m. to 8 p.m. Detectives Pete McDevitt and Pat Rourke stand under a clock that says 2:25, poised, alert, and ready to step out from behind the makeshift ferry shed. Then McDevitt says, "Now," and moves to his right. Rourke, at the same moment, moves to his left. Rourke served a year in Korea. Firemen are Navy, cops are Army. Quinlan knows this. The next line is his. "Okay, Nails, freeze." Cut. The truck with the chickens went into reverse and parked next to the mint-condition 1955 Oldsmobile and an old-fashioned ambulance the size and shape of a station wagon. Before the first take, Mitchell Graham had said, "Sean, you're so perfectly in period that I feel like I should film you in black and white." As McDevitt that day, Zach Terry wore his hat at the same great angle as Quinlan. Graham noticed that. After the first take, he told Quinlan, "It's distracting to have both of you with your hats alike. Could you straighten yours?" The game was called Protecting the Star. Sean knew that game. McDevitt's hat was an important prop today. He shifted his own fedora. "Perfect," said the director. A featured player yields gracefully in the hope that the director will remember when casting in the future. Quinlan wondered how many movies Graham would direct after this one. He wondered what his own career would look like if an indictment came down in California. Crews were setting up for the next scene, which would be shot in front of an old three-story building just across from the piers. For the movie, a sign had been erected on the front that read, "Murphy's Fine Food and Drink, rooms by the day or week." Once this had actually been a waterfront tavern, with rooms rented to sailors on the upper floors. For a while, after the waterfront shut down, it had been a notorious gay bar called The Wrong Box. Carter Boyce, the actor playing Jimmy Nails, was in costume and taking a practice walk toward the ferry shed. Carter Boyce was a nice guy who happened to have a mug 2 feet wide with bad news written all over it. In the next scene, Jimmy Nails was supposed to have just come down the wooden exterior stairs that led from the second floor of Murphy's. He had an overcoat on his arm and carried a satchel. The scene of Nails on those stairs had been completed the day before through the miracle of second unit work. Detectives McDevitt and Rourke stand exactly where they were at the end of the last shot. In the background, as they start to move toward Murphy's, the Oldsmobile and the chicken truck roll off the dock in one direction. Red Studebaker goes by in the other. 20 feet away from them, Jimmy Nails drops his luggage and overcoat and swings a double-barrel shotgun their way. McDevitt, acting instinctively, whips off his fedora and flings it in Nails' face in one gesture. Jimmy, his eyes rolling like a trapped beast, is a creature of instinct and empties a barrel at the hat. Rourke's gun jumps into his hand and he fires 3 times. Jimmy Nails goes down, firing the second barrel into the ground. The hat flying through the air and getting blasted into felt confetti was being shot that same week by a special effects outfit in California. "Thanks," Rourke said. "That hat cost me $5 at Rothman's," says his partner, his buddy. Cut. "Let's put Zach and Sean about a foot further apart," says Graham. "And Sean, slower on the reaction. Let the hat surprise you as much as it does Carter. Sean, are you with us?" Quinlan nodded. For a moment, it felt like the backdraft of the antique vehicles was pulling away from this time and place. Over several takes, the vintage Studebaker blew a tire, and the wind and the sun played hell with Mr. Terry's hair. Half a dozen people surrounded him, spraying his chestnut locks. Exposure to the elements. It's not, of course, but the light makes it look thin. Lighting adjustment. This, Quinlan knew, was also about protecting the star, as was the scene they kept enacting. McDevitt needed to save Rourke's life to mitigate for the audience the fact that his misjudgment was going to cost Rourke his life. As they prepared for what turned out to be the last take, Quinlan couldn't stop thinking, each time he looked at Zach Terry, that this was the bastard who was going to get him killed. At some point during the last couple of takes, Sean Quinlan became aware of a figure from his disreputable past. Roland stood across the street, dark and sharp in a navy blue suede jacket and soft leather shoes, and watched everything that went on. When they were finished with like 60 for the day, he and Roland went down the avenue to what had been a nouveau chic diner and now seemed to be slipping back into just being a diner with a liquor license. "We had some rare adventures, you and I," Rollins remarked, when they settled into a back booth, a pair of theater students out looking for adventure, and not caring where they found it. Always on the right side of the law, though, Not as I remember. There was the time we unloaded the Quaalude, those crazy guys from NYU manufactured in their chemistry lab. We weren't caught. That's being on the right side of the law, as far as I'm concerned. Glad you got in touch. I've been following your career. Sorry about the divorce. Monica Celeste must be loaded. Quinlan shrugged. I see you're still the well-dressed passerby, he said. That routine keeps working for you? In any large city, there are always the lost, the confused, and the lonely, that need an assist from a passing stranger. Rollins gave a charming smile. Actually, though, I've gone legit. I'm in the tourist business. Tours of various old New Yorks. You heard about that. We have people taking day trips to 1890s New York. Out in Brooklyn in a couple of spots, you can walk down a street and almost think it's 125 years ago. Any decade you can think of, people want to see the remains. Roland smiled. It's amazing confluence, you being back in town and making this movie. Like 60 is on the cusp of the hottest boom in this dying city. Your movie is going to be porno for the ones who go for 50s New York. That ferry boat sliding up to the dock and that truckload of chickens. And you and your pal in those hats and padded shoulder suits will make them wet their Dacron rayon pants. Sean gave a grin. In tough times, people want to go elsewhere, Roland said. With every corner of the planet going down the drain, the places they favor are in the past. Some lunatics even want to go back to the Great Depression, like this one isn't bad enough for them. But I don't ask questions. I just set up the tours. Who would have guessed that a master's degree in history from Columbia would stand me in such good stead, especially since you never went there? Roland shrugged. What makes it all weird and twisted, and thus makes it my kind of enterprise, is that some of the clients believe if they can find a place with enough artifacts that evoke a certain time, they'll get a jolt and wind up there. Most of them want to go back to the 70s, the 60s, the 50s. They figure things would be comfortable enough. ID requirements were still loose back then. Sliders know enough about those times that they could make a nice living betting on the World Series and buying Xerox stock. One said that if you could go back to 1950, he'd have almost 60 years before stuff got really screwy. Sean said, you've heard them talk all this out? Ever help any of them do it? None of my clients, and no one else I've ever known, has actually managed the slide. They've all heard about someone going back in time. They know someone who found a message from someone who disappeared, saying he's living like a king in 1946. Psychiatrists say it's delusional. People can't deal with bad times. You believe the shrinks know what they're talking about? They diagnosed me as a sociopath back when I was in high school. It sounded good, and I went with it. If you're looking for a guide to the slide, you're out of luck. If you want a job leading 1950s nostalgia tours, I'll be happy to hire you. Thanks, but I have other plans. Quinlan rose and put a 10 down on the table. Nice talking to you, Rollo. For a moment, Rollins looked hurt. Then he said, sorry to break your heart, Quinlan. It's nice that you figured if anyone in New York knew how to slide, it would be me. You've been in and out of the city over the years without ever trying to get in contact, so I wanted what you wanted. Somehow I didn't think of this. Either you got stupid out in California, or you got very desperate.
I happen to like New York. I happen to like this town. I like the city air. I like to drink of it. The more I know New York, the more I think of it. I like the sight and the sound and even the stink of it. I happen to like New York. I like to go to Battery Park and watch those liners booming in. I often ask myself, why should it be that they should come so far from across the sea? I suppose it's because they all agree with me. They happen to like New York. Last Sunday afternoon, I took a trip to Hackensack.
But after I gave Hackensack the once over, I took the next train back. I happen to like New York. I happen to love this bird. And when I have to give the world a last farewell, and the undertaker starts to ring my funeral bell, I don't want to go to heaven, don't want to go to hell.
John Barrowman. When in doubt, Cole Porter. Sorry about the steel eye span slip that we had there momentarily. Yeah, those span slips that can occur to almost anybody when least you expected, and paparazzi are about. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Richard Bowes, who just read, you told me 30 seconds ago the title, and it slid out of my mind.
On the slide. On the slide. Slid out of your mind.
From the book published.
That will be published on, will come out on July 5th. It's Naked City, and it is a themed anthology. It's urban fantasy, edited by Ellen Datlow.
Speaking of whom...
Yes.
Is there not a reading coming up?
There is a reading for Naked City coming up in Porter Square in Cambridge sometime next month before ReaderCon. I don't know if this means anything.
I think it's like it does. Given the internet, we have listeners all over.
All over the world, yes.
Yes.
Even in Porter Square.
I should say all over the world and Porter Square.
And Cambridge, yes. There will be a reading for that in Cambridge. I think she's also planning to set one up here. But
yeah,
that
well,
isn't
actually,
finalized.
She and I have been talking about
have been talking
that,
about
yeah.
that. Well, that would happen, and I suppose if that happens, I'll read my story again there. There is also a reading coming up for Supernatural Noir,
yeah.
which is another themed anthology. And that
with a bit of crossover between the two, since
they're both dark and they
and
share
urban.
Right and they share a certain number of writers including me and Lucia Shepherd, Jeff Ford, Laird Barron, I think, is in both of them. And, some of us were very lucky here and we got into both of these. And that will be at KGB. And if I wasn't so irrepressibly silly, I would...
I know it's a Friday. It's not this Friday.
No, it's in July. I think it's the third Friday of July.
Ah, okay.
And I know.
Well, we'll announce it on the air. Just before it happens.
And it will be at 7 o'clock on Friday. I think it's Friday, July 23rd. But I would hate to have to sign an oath to this effect.
But people can probably check to be sure. Getting closer to that date by going to rickbowes.com, yes?
They can check, in
R-I-C-K-B-O-W-E-S.
Fact, at this very moment.
Oh, it's on there? Oh,
it's
I
Rickbowes.
Can check.
You can check, yes. They can, oh, goodness gracious, the modern world is just...
Isn't it amazing?
Yes.
If you would like, by the way, you, the listener, to speak with Rick Bowes about his work, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And all the phone over here and remind people again that our guest next week is Paul Witkover. You have 6 days left in which to go to my website, and you'll find a link there to the WBAI archive, which always has the last two episodes of this program. So you can hear the show you're hearing right now again by going there. And also go to, and last week's with Michael Swanwick. So there you go. All righty. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Rick Bowes, I heard you on the show before when you read one of your stories whose title I have forgotten or whose subject matter I have forgotten, which doesn't mean that it was a bad story. It was a very good one. So I was looking forward to this reading. What I found totally lacking in this story was that it was all on one monotone-like level.
Well, that may have been the reading. It was intended to be closer to a noir detective story.
There's always a tightrope walk involved in live reading, something that I know all too well. You know, live performance on live radio at 1:30 in the morning, New York time. You see, we should have gone to London time. Then we would have been more awake.
That's right.
In order to
And the
to
audience
do it.
Would have been entirely confused.
But it's a New York story, so we did it at a New York time.
An appropriate time for a noir story, the
yeah.
middle of the night.
But, you know, we're talking about the story and not the performance, so we will just move on from there. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Mr. Bowes.
Yes.
You mentioned in the story the TV show Sliders. I'm assuming you're referring to the Sliders that was on the SIFI channel.
Actually, it was... I think that was a rebroadcast. Was it originally on the Sci-Fi Channel?
Is it what? Well, I don't know if it was before that, but it was. I saw it on the Sci-Fi Channel.
I think it had two go-rounds.
Yeah.
And I have to say...
It was a network show, I believe.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it did have potential. They should have quit after season one. When they got to the Cro-Mags, it got very silly and it went downhill. Now, if you hadn't mentioned my current favorite, with the exception of Welcome to Bordertown and theme anthology, I would have, and that's Haunted Legends. I loved your Knickerbocker holiday story.
Why, thank you.
Now, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions that there really was a Knickerbocker Tavern.
You are not correct.
Nope.
There was not. As far as I know. Now, there may have been, but...
Oh, it seems like such an obvious name.
There must have been, and also there was, of course, Knickerbocker Beer.
That's right.
Which was the great rival of Rheingold beer. And I remember the ads, television ads, it was Father Knickerbocker would walk into, dressed up in, 18th century drag, would walk into a normal bar and knock three times on the bar. And
mm-hmm.
it was knock twice on the bar, knock, knock for Knickerbocker. But I don't recall a Knickerbocker's. Certainly not in that locale. But bars in which people dressed up, the waitstaff and the doorman dressed up in funny clothes were fairly common. I remember there was a place in Greenwich Village where the doorman, it was a London pub supposedly, and the doorman dressed as yeoman of the guard.
Oh, they still do it actually out west for Frontier Day celebrations.
Yes.
Many small towns do
yes.
that. You've got Leadville, Colorado has a weekend where they'll turn it into a 19th century town and what it was during the silver and gold rush, and they'll have the saloons and they'll have,
By the way, having looked it up, and I thought that it rang a bell, of course, there's the Knickerbocker Bar and Grill, which often has on University Place.
On University Place,
which
yes.
often has really good jazz.
Yes. Yes, and at times has been a cabaret site. But yes, you're right. I mean,
no
things,
relation to the story. But,
no,
but there is a.
By the way, there used to be. I guess it closed. There used to be a Knickerbocker Brewery way
yes.
over on the east side.
Well, that's why Rick
yeah.
mentioned the,
yes,
the beer.
That neighborhood had several breweries in it. I think there was a Rheingold brewery there
yes,
also.
And when the wind was right or not right in the summer, you couldn't help noticing.
You could get drunk just by breathing.
And
yes,
that's not far from where the stock yards were, right?
No, the Knickerbocker Brewery I'm talking about was way over in 90s.
Right,
yeah.
It was up north of York, of Yorkville.
92nd, way over, but where the
the stock yards were where the
UN was, yeah. That neighborhood was, and I do not say this lightly, one of the toughest Irish neighborhoods I have ever seen. It's gone now, but I mean it was, and was shrinking even when I saw it in the 60s. But that was one tough, mean neighborhood.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about this story, Knickerbocker holiday. I'm assuming the Flying Dutchman fashion company was named after the fashion outfit you worked for.
Again, no.
Okay.
All of the Dutch stuff was brought in. I did work for a company like that, and I'm going to tell you, I for some reason remember the word feathers, but I'm not.
I hope you didn't have a boss like Bud Van Brunt.
Not quite that awful.
He's terrible.
Yeah, he was not a good employer. But that was on my way down in the fashion copywriting business.
But he did remind me of Brom Bones, though, very much so.
It was reading the thing that surprised me when I read Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle was the way that Washington Irving created an entire mythos with those two short stories. I don't think he did not write another Dutch New York short story in his entire career. Those were in the sketchbook at the start of his career. And really, they gave us an entire myth system.
Yes, except for the fact that there are some traditional Hudson Valley legends. As I was reading that particular story, there was an actual thunderstorm outside, and I was very much imagining Henry Hudson and his crew.
Hudson Hendon playing nine pins, yes. When I was
filling that cider that apparently put Rip out for 20 years.
That must have been one hell of a cider.
Yes.
When I was a kid, we had a recording of Walter Houston, who had played. Rip Van Winkle was a standard American theater part. All actors of a certain status and age played Rip Van Winkle.
Sort of the American version of a pantomime, I guess.
Well, I guess. And Houston had done that. I mean, he was Canadian, but he had done that, and his performance as Rip Van Winkle is on that old record is astounding. On the other side of the record was Bing Crosby doing The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, which, of course, that was the soundtrack to the Disney cartoon. What the Houston thing was, I don't know. It was just a freeform performance. But the Dutch stuff in the book is kind of extrapolated. Most of that is stuff that I made up.
Well, let's put it this way. There could have been maybe 200 years ago a place where Brom Bones and, as you say, his night riders or his gang came, you know, riding down and sat drinking there. And, you know, and of course, the idea of the scam that Jay Glass put on, making, you know, what's her name tell the story of seeing, you know, Brunt's ghost, could have been similar to the scam that Brom Bones put on, you know, to win, as you said, what's her name, Tassel.
Katrina von Tassel.
Great name.
At one point when I was working at NYU, we had a young student assistant named Van Tassel. Her first name was not Katrina, but she was from that area, and she and her family believed that they were the Van Tassels of the Washington Irving story, which I think may well have been. They may well have been.
You know, Jane Yolen, in one of her Sister Light novels, actually created a folklorist named Nicholas Van Tassel, and it was such a creation that there were people who actually went looking for his ballad collection in bookstores.
Well, you know, the thing about Dutch New York is that 50 years ago, this was a much bigger presence than it is now. It's something that I've seen go away. It wasn't just Knickerbocker beer. It, you know, they were still a recognizable ethnic group.
There was, in fact, just in the last year or two, a documentary on PBS.
Yes, on Dutch New York.
On Dutch New York?
Yeah, I watched that. I wish I had seen it before I wrote the story.
There is actually a book out. I don't think it's out of print, by a man named Moritz Jakendorf, called Legends of Dutch New York. And it's a collection of maybe 13 or 14 stories, including the how the Baker's Dozen came to be, and also how New Amsterdam became New York because of a swimming contest between Peter Stuyvesant's trumpeter, who was supposed to warn him when the British were coming, the British fleet, but he was engaged in a swimming bout across a treacherous body of water up in northern Manhattan with the devil.
Well, an appropriate person, by the way, to have spoken about some of this stuff with was my guest 2 weeks ago, Lawrence Watt Evans, whose family, the Evans family, owned a farm.
Up there?
Here.
Oh, here.
In New Amsterdam.
New Amsterdam. Yeah. Well, as I say, and we still have, of course, that treacherous body of water, Spuyten Duyvel.
Spuyten Duyvel.
Which is a very treacherous body for swimmers. I mean, I know people who've swum San Francisco Bay, and they say that Spuyten Duyvel is just as bad, just as treacherous.
Who is the author or the editor?
Moritz, Maurits Jakendorf, Jagendorf. He's written about 40 or 50 collections of stories from different parts of the United States. He actually had a collection from the Atlantic states called Upstate, Downstate. He has some from the South. He has one from the Midwest called Sand in the Bag. And this is called Legends of Dutch New York. And their legends start actually from the founding of New Amsterdam to the late 17th century, including the real story of Leisler's Rebellion, Jacob Leisler.
Oh, God.
Yes. The next to the last governor.
That's a gory story.
It is. And he lets it all hang out.
Took place basically right in front of the building that we currently inhabit.
120 Wall Street?
Well, think about it. It was on Wall Street that they drawn quartered people right by the river. And where we are now is probably landfill, Water Street.
Right.
Which is half a block west of us, is what would have been the water line at that point. So that's probably where the execution referred to in that rebellious story occurred.
Didn't
so
they actually,
a half a block from here.
Didn't they actually, Jim, find a cemetery full of ex-slaves' bodies down
Well,
here?
Sure. I mean, it's a museum down here.
Museum down there.
Yeah. I mean, this is, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, there's now the Irish Holocaust Museum at the northern end of Battery Park, which is very interesting. Anyway, Rick, you're doing so many wonderful stories. I'll tell you, currently, Haunted Legends is my favorite, and I like the concept of the local.
Well, that's the anthology,
story,
not
the anthology.
The story.
Yes. Anyway, good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. And if you'd, we have, time is like gone. We have 10 minutes left, less than 9 minutes till we put on the theme. But if you would like to call up and speak with Rick Bowes about his work or what you have been hearing, the telephone number here, WBAI, is 212-209-2900. And so right now, not counting all these anthologies, but books in print that bear your name on the spine as opposed to on the cover. Is Streetcar Dreams still?
Streetcar Dreams is still available.
That's PS Publishing,
I think? PS Publishing. But it is an English imprint. But there's always a copy for sale somewhere. That's a collection of short stories. And certainly... Minions is around.
Minions of the Moon.
Minions of the Moon is around, and From the Files of the Time Rangers is around. They're all obtainable. It's much easier to find books at this point than it was. I mean, at any given moment.
I am really praying and hoping that one of the future things that technologies are bringing to us, that there's no need for any book ever to be out of print again if print on demand actually gets to be you know, good. All those books that have gone out of print should be available.
That's
for the future. It's not immediately today, but I am so constantly frustrated that X, Y, and Z, an author is out of print.
It is too bad, but I do find that with the online sellers, usually there are used copies available.
Yeah.
And even for things that are that are no longer available new, they are around.
Yeah, and you can always go to Amazon, to Powell Books, to Google Books.
Able
is a good one.
Able Online, yeah.
Able Online. There are so it's one, surprisingly, one of the benefits of the internet age have been easier access to books.
Yes. And yes, I think probably at some point everything will be available if you care to obtain them electronically.
Shouldn't be that far off in the future.
I don't think so. But yes.
It's got more legal issues than technology issues.
Right, although the legal issues are
stupendous.
Yes.
Yeah, just taking a look at what's going on with Google Books
right.
and their attempt to scan libraries. They just made a deal with the British Library.
Yes, I know.
This is your field. We'll take another call. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio.
Good morning. You were just talking about the difficulty of obtaining out-of-print books and such.
Well, actually, the ease with which it can be done now, but go on.
I was reminded of Gutenberg.org and manybooks.net.
Right.
And the fact that I find writers who have been dead only a year or two, I find the works in public domain.
It's not that simple, no.
No,
all of H. Beam Piper's work are available for download for free.
That's because H. Beam Piper's family did not renew copyrights
Correct.
For many years. It's got
I
nothing
know.
To do with
I'm
this.
Going back to the 80s.
Yeah.
I just saw,
so it's what they it's that
it's a state issue.
It's a state issue, and what they call an orphaned work.
Orphaned work. Some of Tom Dish's work is orphaned work already.
That would, Mr. You know, Tom was not as careful about things as he might have been.
And Tom put a lot of stuff on the internet.
New Yorkers knew he was around. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, but Tom was not careful, and he posted a lot of his own stuff on the internet. On his blog and things like that. And once you do that, you are giving other people the right to copy it.
Yeah, I guess you are. I find it disturbing in some ways. It's wonderful that this stuff is not dying. It's wonderful you can find, again, R.A. Lafferty. You can find Space Shanty online for free. But it disturbs me. These people are being, you know,
I would have to
be remembered.
I would have to say that if a work like Lafferty or Piper is available for free, that this is carelessness, and in some cases means that there is no heir.
There is no heir. No. That's exactly the issue with Mr. Piper, I believe.
It's hard. I mean,
in which case the question is, who is being ripped off? If there is no heir, if there is nobody who is a claimant to the orphaned work.
Having just settled in the state, I really find it hard to believe that there's anything that doesn't have some owner somewhere. If there is no one who will step forward and claim the work, which is the case, then I see no reason why it shouldn't become part of public domain.
I'm as concerned with keeping this great literature alive.
Well, I would think that would keep it alive.
I hope so.
You know? It's really such a double-edged sword.
Scalzi has, didn't Scalzi?
John Scalzi.
Scalzi just did a Fuzzy's book.
That's right, he did.
And this, I would think, would spur interest in the stories.
Little Fuzzy, for those people who don't know, by H. Beam Piper and John Scalzi, who's coincidentally the current president of the Science Fiction Writers of America and therefore not likely to step on other people's rights.
No. No, I'm sure any, you know, all precautions were taken, but...
so to speak.
Yes. but I don't know. You know, things going into public domain should be made... That would make them more available, I would think, not less.
And there's not a marketing department behind them, sir. I think one of your great skills is you're such a fantastic reader. I think you have a great future.
Why, thank you. I think my future is mostly in the past.
You're there to sell your work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. It takes a person who writes about time travel to say that your future is in the past, I must say.
Yeah, I, you know, my future is retirement, I think. But it's...
I trust not, actually. The writing bug, is it, whatever, is too instilled in you, and you do it all too well.
Well, thank you. It's very odd. I mean, the electronic revolution, you know, electronics, while in some ways it has wiped out parts of publishing, also has made books more available.
Yeah, and this is the same kind of thing that has happened with a lot of music. It's anything that is based on that old question of the right to copy something, and
yeah.
Should intellectual property be based, you know, as the concept of a copy is changing in technology, I think we need to be rethinking. This is the difficult question. How do you protect intellectual property but not base it on copies made? It's
yes.
Difficult.
It's very hard.
And as people pass on, their estates pass on, if their estates are sold to, like, you know, it's not like anybody who ever was related to Edgar Rice Burroughs has any rights to the John Carter of Mars. These are corporations who are,
yes,
you know, buying the copyrights and,
yeah,
and doing that. You know, it's all a huge issue. That would be, well, another show.
Another show, yes.
Because we're actually, well, about, not only about out of time, we are out of time for this morning's show. It has gone all too quickly, as they always do, even when we have 2 hours, and, well, less so when we have 90 minutes. But thank you for being here on this second of your Hour of the Wolves in the non-Hour of the Wolf time slot.
Well, it's always the Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, somewhere.
Somewhere in the world.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And you'll be back soon, I trust.
I assume so. Like a drunkard to the bottle.
There you go. So listeners should go to rickbowes.com, RICKBOWES.
.com, and there are a bunch of my stories are there that you can read, and pictures of my toys. Oh, there's all kinds of stuff. You can amuse yourself,
yes,
endlessly there.
And ourwolf.com if you want to hear things. And speaking of toys, well, I have to talk about this some other time, but you can all now listen to my flying monkey. Can you? Ah. There we go. And if you want to know more about my flying monkey, well, write me a letter, Jim at ourwolf.com. I will not send you a picture of my flying monkey. I'm no relation to Anthony Weiner. Okay, so thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. with myself and Paul Witkover. And again, thank you, Rick Bowes.
Thank you.
Oh, be sure to stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming right up.
nation out of system.
Burn it.
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
You're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, WBAI.org. Burn, baby, burn. Used to be 4 o'clock, now it's 3 o'clock. Yeah. Burn, baby, burn. Now it goes from 3 on till 5 o'clock when Al Jazeera English kicks in. This is Steel Pulse when they were hard and stiff.
Me, yeah. My lovely, you disown me. Music that you're dancing to.
at exactly 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. The Pulse, David Hines, lead singer, when he was hard and stiff and couldn't ever miss, yeah. 71 degrees on the outside. Lister until Al Jazeera kicks in. 99 Cinco WBAI. So we do it.